And good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland. It is your community radio station, and it is Thursday morning. We're getting ready to start Between the Covers in just about a minute or so. Today, David Naiman will be speaking to author Yanara Friedland about her book, Uncountry, A Mythology, A Poetic Reimagining of Myth. That's coming right up here on The Boo. Hey, KBOO keeps you informed and involved, and we need your help. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of An Evening with Dan Levinson at Kennedy Violins on Saturday, August 26th at Kennedy Violins in Vancouver. His stage show, An Evening with Dan Levinson, is an intimate evening of musical conversation that combines old-time fiddle, Appalachian banjo, stories and song in a storytelling format to tell the story of life in rural Appalachia and life on the road. Again, that's An Evening with Dan Levinson at Kennedy Violins on Saturday, August 26th at 4 p.m. at Kennedy Violins, 508 Southeast 117th Avenue in Vancouver. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering locally roasted coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffee House.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest, Yanara Friedland, is a German-American writer, translator, and teacher. Friedland has a doctorate in creative writing from the University of Denver and is the recipient of a 2016 German Academic Exchange Service research grant in support of a collection of essays written collaboratively in the German, Polish, and U.S.-Mexican borderlands. Friedland is the author of the chapbook Abrac Adhabra, I Will Create As I Speak, published by Essay Press. She was also a member of the poets' theater group GASP, Girls Assembling Something Perpetual, and on the board of the directors of POG, the poetry collective and reading series in Tucson, Arizona. Yanara Friedland is here today on Between the Covers to talk about her latest book, the winner of the Noemi Press Fiction Prize, entitled Uncountry, A Mythology. Publishers Weekly says of Uncountry, Friedland's unclassifiable hybrid debut balances the fantasy of myth and the linguistic grace of poetry in works of prose. Subtitled A Mythology, the book gathers myths, origin stories, and fairy tales and ties them to modernity to weave a narrative of humans' dreams and endless wanderings. Friedland crafts with grace and care a book like a translated dream, messy but familiar, brimming with something just beyond one's grasp. Writer Lily Huang adds, as a descendant of Chantal Ackerman and Una Kazurn, among others, Friedland reimagines the origin myth. Friedland's permeable pages allow the reader entryway into a mirror that becomes an open door, a door through which we hear the echo of Anna Mendieta telling us there is no original past to redeem, there is the void. Uncountry is an invitation to that void, and Friedland serves as dream guide through this blend of the personal, political, and stunningly poetic. Welcome to Between the Covers, Yanara Friedland.
Good to be here.
So, Uncountry, A Mythology, as this introduction suggests, engages with origin stories and myths, with Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Ishmael, Hansel and Gretel. They all travel through the book, but sort of like in dreams where time is given a spatial dimension, their occurrence is overlaid with characters from other times. They're passing through a world that is also the world of you and your family, of 20th century wars, displacements, refugee migrations, and another way to look at it might be that you and your family are passing through a world still inhabited by these origin stories and myths. So maybe we can start with the origin story of Uncountry as a project. How did you come to conceive of it, and what were some of the animating questions behind you starting this book project?
So I I would start by saying that a lot of these stories came to me in one way or another. They met me as I was thinking about family histories. I was thinking about the different countries that I've lived in and that have formed me, and in some ways that I wanted to reflect back on. And there were certain histories, particularly in my family, that I was really intrigued by, but that I only had sort of anecdotal information about. So part of the initial writing was an attempt to fill in these gaps and to really explore some of the legends of my family, or some of the myths that had been passed down, and then to write around them and filling in with my own imagination, filling sort of in that space that where there was nothing, where there was silence. So I would say one of the earliest stories I wrote was the walk through the Harz Mountains, which in some ways is a retracing of the story of my grandfather after the war. And I was very intrigued by his character. I never met him. And I had some facts and pieces that I was working with, but then there was a large silence around his life story and what had happened. So I decided, in some ways, as a way to enter his story, was to physically retrace where he had been. And one place he had been were the Harz Mountains, where he deserted as a soldier and basically walked from Eastern Germany all the way to Western Germany in the sort of last throes of World War II. So I did this walk, and that's where a lot of the writing began with his story. Another strand, of course, is the Jewish family. So I had I actually traveled to the Ukraine, traveled to Odessa, where some of my ancestors came from, and did a similar kind of archaeological tracing or a digging up, where I was visiting sites and writing specifically at those sites around those people that I had never met before.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about what an uncountry is for you? Because I think this is crucial to people who haven't yet read the book, this space that you've created where the book happens.
I think uncountry means a lot of things to me. It's hard to sort of just say that this is the one definition I would give. Of course, there's the Helene Sissou. She actually handed that to me, so I was reading Helene Sissou quite extensively at the time, and she talks about this term uncountry, which she uses. I think in one instance she talks about it in relationship to theater, but then she also talks about it in this book, Three Steps on the Ladder of Writing. And I was really struck by the term, but also the way she talks about it as a word that does not exist, and this idea that a word that does not exist, which I experience quite frequently, right? Being German, and then sort of there's being certain words that I know in German that I can't find in the English language. And so what happens with words or ideas that don't exist, and how do we bring them into existence, into a kind of consciousness? So that was interesting to me, but also the notion that there is a space that is not so uncountry to me. In some ways, is a lot about a kind of belonging that exists outside of national, tribal, cultural belonging, and it's something that comes together for me in the weave of contentious storylines, and the way they kind of accrete, and the way they sort of supplement and speak to each other, and how can belonging be created through that, through storylines that are contentious and that in some ways are not really they don't really belong to each other, and yet they somehow exist in the same space. So that was another piece for me that was interesting. And uncountry also for me means the country that is other to us, right? The space that I don't, that I'm not familiar with. So it's kind of an approach of the unfamiliar, of otherness, of something that is mysterious and that sort of is underneath or next to or beyond my reach.
Well, she seems, Ellen Sisu seems like the perfect emblem of the uncountry in the sense of being a French Algerian Jew who didn't associate as being primarily as being French or Algerian, and it's this idea of displacement also when we think about I believe it was her mother who was fleeing Nazi Germany and her dad who was from Algeria but originally was from the expulsion from Spain. So you have all these displaced narrative histories that I imagine would have a certain resonance for you with all of the countries you've lived in and then this mystery around your own ancestry.
Yeah, and that's of course another layer to it. So displacement, all the storylines in Uncountry deal in one way or another with displacement, various diasporas, various forms of exile. So I'm very interested in the sort of those in the migratory and the way in which also origin in some ways, you know, when you start tracing back origin stories or you start trying to figure out where something comes from, that it's you notice very quickly that there isn't really one place, right? So there isn't really one country, one sort of fixed position. It becomes something much more moving and ambivalent, I guess.
Well, when we think about exile and displacement and removal, which seems like, as you mentioned, a recurring motif in this book, not just the modern motif around Nazi Germany and the Holocaust, but even the way you put on equal footing the stories that get erased in the Bible. So we have the story of Lilith in relationship to Eve, Hagar in relationship to Sarah, Ishmael in relationship to Isaac. The stories that sort of get pushed out of the center from the biblical story. Could you talk a little bit about what you're interrogating and what the presence of these figures is doing for Uncountry?
Yeah, so for me, I would start by saying that I've always really loved those figures. I grew up with sort of stories from the Old Testament, from the Hebrew Bible, and was always really fascinated by the sparseness of the accounts. So drastic things happen in a very quick succession. We're not really told ever why. It's just sort of there are these leaps made in the narrative that we're supposed to follow as the reader. And I was always struck by that and thinking about what actually, you know, we never get really an indication of the inner lives of these figures either. So what happens really internally when, for example, you know, Abraham takes Isaac up to Mount Moriah and is attempting this sacrifice that fails. How does Isaac feel about that? We never know, right? So that to me was always really intriguing and captivating. I would say that for Uncountry specifically, I was interested in the kind of universal themes that are held in those storylines too. So themes of betrayal, of sacrifice. So these are ancient stories and yet they reverberate into the present. And we can, even though there might not be a binding in that sense imaginable now, there's still reverberations around the theme between father and son, for example, Abraham and Isaac. But specifically, I was interested in even, you know, in these shadow characters. So Hagar, for example, who's the maid of Sarah, right, who really gets very little space in the original source text. And so part of what I was doing and what I was interested in is sort of looking at the ancient rabbinical form of commentary called Midrash and sort of attempting a kind of midrashic commentary on those stories. So I would look at those short pieces and then sort of start to provide my own commentary on how I was reading between the lines into those absences. So that's Midrash is attempts to provide a commentary on a source text, on the Torah, and provides a sort of manifold reading, a kind of hermeneutics. And what is interesting about Midrash is that there's really, if you look at the Talmud and you have all these rabbis arguing with each other in the margins, it's never really, it's never about coming to a conclusive resolution. It's really just about consolidating multiple viewpoints on top of the source text and sort of contending with it, which I find is a really appealing way to approach truth or approaching the essence of a story. Mm. And so fables and legends and anecdotes and hearsay would all sort of congregate around these source texts. And so that was a technique that I used for On Country, and specifically starting with these origin myths, if you will.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to writer Yanara Friedland about her latest book, On Country, A Mythology. You once said about your book that, in essence, the task the book proposes is to string and build connection to that and those beyond our immediate association of nation and citizenship, the identity markers we are born into, and to imagine lineages that live within us contradicting inherited narratives. I do think, however, that this must always happen after a confrontation and untangling of our more immediate bonds, or in other words, the reaching beyond ourselves begins at the center, slowly rippling out. I want to emphasize that this is not a territorial act, claiming all kinds of subjectivities as our own, but rather an encounter at the boundary of I and thou, in Buber's words. I was hoping you could talk more about the difference between claiming subjectivities as our own and the encounter at the boundary of I and thou, coming from Martin Buber's philosophy. Could you maybe parse that out a little bit for us?
So I think, in part, that the quote that you just read speaks to an approach I have when I write, and especially with this book. Something I did was really imagining myself in a room or in a place with these subjects, these people, also stories or experiences, sometimes objects that I was engaging with. And so it was very much about the meeting space between myself and let's say a particular place, a particular landscape, and seeing what happened in between. So it's a little bit difficult to explain exactly what that looks like, but for me it has something about where there's part of myself that approaches, and part of the other that approaches, and there's something new that happens in the middle, and it's almost like a kind of third space, right? We can think of that, and I think Margaret Yersinia speaks about the lacuna, right? Mm-hmm. That when she was writing the memoirs of Adrian, she was kind of very much, it was very much about sort of bringing herself there, and also very much sort of imagining Adrian, but then something completely other actually sort of coming out of that space in between their intersections, or where they intersected. And so I like that presence of the third as an idea, so that I don't want to pretend that I don't exist in that encounter, which is why for me the I is an important thread throughout the book. But I also am not interested in memoir per se, as just sort of, you know, that it's just about myself. So there's something about balancing those two spaces and acknowledging their existence in equal measure. In terms of not fully claiming other subjectivities, I think it's a little bit more complicated. I would say, you know, if I had decided to, for example, write, and I think in that way I'm also more comfortable with fragments and sort of this idea of the midrashic literature, right, where we can where it's more about constellation and almost creating a kaleidoscope rather than sort of just asserting one version. So in that way, we get to see multiple subject positions, and that feels to me a little bit more real, perhaps, than fully assuming one position and then writing from that place.
I don't know if this is a stretch to make this comparison, but when I think about what you're saying about the boundary between I and thou and this third entity or thing that's created in that interaction, I wondered if you felt similarly about borders, whether the border between, because you've walked borders as part of your process of creating art, are borders between countries a third thing more than what we think of them? Or does that feel like a little bit of a stretch to take that that existential communion to a geographic space?
No, I think that's actually quite accurate. I think there's something that happens at borders that is very unique, and that's been part of my interest in them, is that there is, of course, it's there are things that go on the geopolitical border that are highly problematic, and I don't want to just think of it as this wonderfully invigorating, inspiring place. But it's true that also having lived in the borderlands, in the desert, having visited a lot of borders in Europe, that there are certain possibilities and potentials at the border, as much as there are divisions and separations that I think are worthwhile exploring. And one, you know, in a very sort of simplistic way, you could say, you know, a border, as much as it divides and sort of keeps apart, it also joins, right? So the joining part and the kind of the meeting that happens between and the overlap too, right? Because a border is never actually clear cut. So even though you might have that geopolitical line, when you walk the border, you notice that that's a much more there's much more space that feels like a bordering transition space that where lots of things come to mingle and coexist in very interesting ways. So it's also where, from a scientific point of view, I was talking to someone who's been studying sort of the from a botanical or even geological point of view, that what happens in sort of certain border zones, and it's he was telling me that that's where things get wonky. So, you know, pine trees growing next to cactuses, for example. So things kind of that don't necessarily traditionally belong to each other somehow coexisting in that. So that to me is an exciting possibility to look into.
Yeah. So by confronting displacement, whether in ancestral narratives with Hagar and Ishmael or with actual contemporary wars, the Uncountry also by comparison seems to also be looking at the issue of home and belonging. And the book opens with a quote from the Cuban American sculptor and performance artist Ana Mendieta. And in it she says, "There is no original past to redeem. There is the void, the orphanhood, the unbaptized earth of the beginning, the time that from within the earth looks upon us. There is above all the search for origin." And this seems to suggest, at least to me, that the search for home is not a search for a geographical home, as you've mentioned yourself, but also that orphanhood might be a primordial human state in some sense, that one finds home in the search for home, not in landing in a space of home. I was wondering if you could just elaborate a little on how Ana Mendieta finds herself at the beginning of Uncountry.
Yeah, I've for a long time been really influenced by her work, and I love that quote. Actually, her writing is quite marvelous. She's obviously known more for her performance and earthworks, but this particular piece and the idea of origin was really speaking to me as a gate through which to walk into Uncountry, because it is, in some ways, that's where it started as a seeking or a searching for origin, for a kind of home, for a kind of belonging, and yet realizing that it's actually more of an orphanhood that the book inhabits, or that where the book lands. And so I was also thinking a lot about Simone Weil's notion of that we need to be rooted in the absence of place. So the rooting in an absence of place, or the rooting in the not being home, becomes a kind of home as well. So to me, those ideas are really important, and in some ways, I think also home is something that needs to be maybe redefined as a term. I mean, lots of the moment, lots of the words that I use in Uncountry that are sort of the titles for certain pieces are also an attempt to reinscription. So trying to think about what does origin actually mean, or what does betrayal maybe mean, what is sort of breaking open language and sort of dissecting it in a certain way, and looking behind what is that word covering that hasn't been sort of thought of before. And so home for me is a big word, and it's burdened, and it feels heavy. And so part of the walk with Uncountry was about trying to make it lighter, and also trying to claim it in a new way.
Well, I like that you say part of the walk of Uncountry, because I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, or hear more from you a little bit about walking in relationship to finding home in the search for home. Because I know you walking is a big practice for you, it seems like. And that I've also read that you like to write when you're in movement, on a train, crossing an ocean. And I would love to know about creating literature through walking for you. If walking is a gesture towards searching for home, is the movement through space more important than where you're walking towards when you're doing the walks? And is it connected to any past practices of walking? Do you see it connected to pilgrimage, or do you see it connected to the movement of refugees, forced walking?
Yeah, I think again, walking holds many different sort of motivators, and there are lots of reasons why people walk. And so part of my second manuscript, Abracadabra, being part of that manuscript, was about really exploring the different ways people walk and what walking can hold. And one aspect was forced migration. I was looking at people crossing the Mediterranean, and I had been interviewing asylum seekers and refugees who had come into Europe after their journey was complete, and then also looking at walking as pilgrimage. So I was looking at a lot of pilgrimage. There are lots of roads and pathways and ancient pilgrimage trails throughout Europe that you can still walk. So I was doing some walking there and writing while I was on pilgrimage. And then another aspect of walking for me has to do with actually similarly to the way writing happens, which is that a lot of it is about being nowhere particular. So it's a kind of dislocation that I appreciate when I'm in a writing space, and a way of being almost just an observation and in witness, staring at things, getting lost in things, being disoriented, that is productive for me. So walking as a physical activity is the closest I can get to that state, and that resembles writing for me. So I do like to write in movement, but maybe even what I like more than writing is really just thinking and sort of being in the world, being sort of wrapped in it in a way that is not necessarily about making sense of it.
Yeah. Do you see, do you associate the idea of like of a movable space, of home, finding home in movement as a particularly Jewish thing? And I think of a couple things with regards to that. Like, for instance, I think of Hebrew being sort of this transitional language in a way that it's both still pictorial, it's referencing a actual space and what was seen in that space, and yet it's also phonetic. And so it's portable in a way. It's like exile can happen within the language of the, I don't know if I'm making sense, but I'm curious about, yeah, about movable spaces and wandering with regards to Jewish identity, if you had any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a lot to say about the way Jewish identity is often built on that idea, right? So which is also why text is so important, right? Traditionally, because it's something that is portable, something that can be, you know, in the absence of a physical homeland, we have books, we have texts that can be carried, stories. So that, I think that is that's definitely very much a sort of Jewish practice. The other thing that is interesting, if you look at Yiddish, for example, as a language, you know, this was a language that was never canonized fully, or that had real issues at being canonized, and it was sort of this hybrid language that was sort of mixing Slavic and Hebrew and German, and it was sort of hard to place, and so it was something that people, when writing in Yiddish initially, or even sort of in the like 18th, 19th century in Europe, it was hard to call it literature or to have a readership for it. And so it was also something that developed because of the movement, you know, of Jewish people in particularly Eastern Europe, and never really having one particular place where they could practice their language. So it became this kind of mishmash. And that, I think, is, again, very particular to the Jewish identity. I think I am very interested in Jewish stories around exile and sort of nomadic living, whether that is because of, you know, being forced to or by choice, but having this kind of nomadic existence. I think there's a lot to be explored there, and yet also more recently, I found myself wanting to not over-identify with that either. The archetype of the wandering Jew, you know, it's an archetype. And again, as with other archetypes, there's some real truth to that, and it's very compelling to explore that lineage. And yet I also think it can cover up something that might be more relevant. Or not more relevant, but perhaps more comprehensive, and inclusive. So it's definitely an aspect of Jewish identity, and I think there are other things to look at as well that perhaps are not considered when just thinking of Jews as wandering, as moving, as sort of homeless.
Yeah. Well, if we think about holding a space open for complexity, which I think the Uncountry does, one of the ways in which I feel like it does this is with the first prologue, which I'm hoping you'll speak a little bit about, because it feels like it does some work to set up some expectations around the book. It's a brief story of an unnamed woman in Germany whose husband dies and who quickly becomes homeless, a wanderer, a refugee, hungry and starving, who ends up murdering a random old woman on the road for her shoes and her food. And it seems somehow important to me that this unnamed woman who opens the book is both a victim and a victimizer. I would love to hear what this prologue is why it's in this place in the book, and what your thoughts are on it.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought of that specifically, this idea of victim and victimizer. I think that story, that prologue, came actually directly out of a sort of midrashic exercise I did on some specific lines from, I believe it was both coming from the story of Lilith that I was reading, and then also, or the little excerpts I could find on her, but then also the story of Ruth, who's another kind of important female figure in the Hebrew Bible. And so I was, again, interested in both of those women are sort of anti-heroines. You know, they're not, they do things that are problematic, that are dark, that are using power in ways that trespass. And so I think when I started writing that particular story, I was interested in the way women have trespassed throughout history. Mm. And also it was in some ways an inversion of the Adam and Eve story too. So thinking of that story and how Lilith, for example, interrupts the narrative of Adam and Eve. So Lilith being the first wife of Adam and being the more rebellious female partner in some ways who's banned. God bans her after she supposedly refuses to have intercourse with Adam and being, I think, below him. That was the argument. And so as a consequence, Adam asks God to ban her. And so she's banned actually to the Black Sea. So there was this link to, you know, one of my ancestors coming from the Black Sea, and then this, at least in my mind, she's at the Black Sea. Maybe she's at the Red Sea, but in my mind, it's like she's at the Black Sea, and she's kind of wandering, and she's banished. And this idea of banishment was important for the Lilith chapter as a kind of entry point. So the prologues, in some ways, also for me function as gateways. So they kind of set up what happens thematically and almost in terms of tone, what follows in that particular history.
I think this would be a great time to hear some of the prose, if you didn't mind reading a little bit of the prologue, just so people can get a sound of the mm-hmm. the music and syntax of it too.
Soon the soil split and cracked, plants hurled into the coronaries of the earth. Then eels and households descended into what was once solid. Noises were sealed by walls of loam. This is not the black forest of dreams or some infernal after. Here she was, fully unbraided, blood-crusted, with shivering knees. Here she was, a gallant prop elemented by wilderness, and did not think of widowhood, her burials, and murders. Witnesses disappeared. She waited until all was over. People came out of their nests and birds landed among the tree carcasses. A man by a small fire smiled at her, and she wondered if he was the kinsman redeemer, if she should offer her sandal so he could acquire her. She lay down by his feet. Some of his toes were missing. She rolled herself into a snail and waited for his hand on her hair. But the man gazed into the fire and spoke in a language she had never heard before. In fact, he did not speak at all through his tongue, but released what the quake had swallowed from his schlund. He offered a fern of fire, and though she knew better, she accepted. The flame clenched in her fist. She keenly waited to see what else he would do to her. He took her hair between his hands and rubbed the streaks as if they had caught a cold. The world was still humming from rupture, and they used world and collapsed things to make gifts for each other. By the next day, they had towers of dog legs, orioles, pots, hot potatoes, bones, and a collection of tongues, eyes, and other body parts. And although she never knew who that man by the fire was, and why he so kindly looked after her with rumbling noises and eager hands, endeared by all the wrong parts, he spent hours stroking her eyelids, massaging her nails, shielding her armpits. And although she was not quite sure why he did not want to move inside of her like all the other men in time wanted to, why he lacked complete interest in her breasts, lips, and all the meanings between her legs. She stayed close to him and slept by his feet and missing toes. And although they could not make the other understand their thoughts, they garbled their minds and hearts to one another.
You've been listening to Yanara Friedland read from Uncountry, a Mythology. The word garbled seems important to me in this book. The way time is garbled, the seasons are garbled, meaning feels garbled. There's this strange feeling of saying the word garbled when you say it, when anyone says garbled. But there's also a strangeness to the syntax often in the book. So the speaking of Uncountry isn't garbled, but it feels like it has that strange feeling of saying the word garbled. And it made me think of something that the LA Review of Books said in a comment about Uncountry, that there was a double mourning happening in the book, the mourning of what is lost and the mourning of the loss of language to describe what is lost. And I was wondering if about the emotional work this sort of defamiliarized language is doing in the book. If you could talk a little bit about what you're doing on the sentence level with some of the language that you're choosing. This strange, an estranging sort of language.
Can I ask, what could you say a little bit more what feels estranging about it?
Just the sense that maybe estranging is not the right word, but that the text calls attention to its itself as material. It's not the sort of book that you open it, you enter a fictive spell, and you come out having lived in, you know, when people say, the words just disappeared and I was transported. This somehow, like the soil of Uncountry is also the words that are evoking the Uncountry. That's not just the Uncountry evoked by the words.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make any sense?
Yeah, that's no, it does. I'm interested. I'm actually interested in how people read it, because I, you know, it's always a different, it's a different experience. In terms of language, I would say that because my first language is German and English, but English is the language I write in, that there seems to be I seem to have a natural tendency for a syntax that's slightly in translation. So, and I'm interested in that too, because part what happens when you move to a new country, or when you acquire a new language, it's about assimilating, right? It's about sort of adopting the intonations and the way, listening closely to how people speak in that place. And I'm, as a writer, interested in what happens when you maintain somewhat of the original foreignness of where you came from. So, which is also why there's some German throughout the book, right? There's some words that kind of pop up here and there that interrupt or disrupt the English, the movement of English language. So for me, the being in multiple places and not just being under the spell of English, for example, was important, and also to actively acknowledge that these different origins or these different places can't just be neatly assimilated into English. That would feel false in some ways.
Well, when you look at the different women artists that this book is in conversation with, Anna Mendieta, who's directly interrogating sort of a sense of exile and displacement from Cuba, and Ellen Sitsu, who is also with this idea of Uncountry, but in general, you know, where does she belong is a significant question. You also quote Clarice Lispector. I'm going to read a quote that she said, but both of you are writing in a language that's not your mother tongue, her being a Ukrainian Jew who's living in Brazil. And she said, writing is the method of using the word as bait, the word fishing for whatever is not word. Once whatever is between the lines is caught, the word can be tossed away in relief. The non-word, taking the bait, incorporates it. So what saves you is writing absent-mindedly. It feels like maybe that's something of what you're talking about having this double syntax, that finding that gap or finding that strangeness in the gap between the two languages.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love that idea of the word as bait, right? Because in some ways, language is always limiting, right? There's a sense of trying to capture something that you can't actually fully capture in language, and yet it's a necessary method at getting something across, or at sort of claiming something fully. So I like the idea of bait a lot.
Yeah. Jesus. Well, if you'd be willing, I would love it if you'd... There's another section that the language really leapt out to me. It's on page 21.
Her favorite story is death. When you die, you go down along a wall of stones pointing out of the earth like large bones. When you die, you fall down a well and bring blood to the moon's reflection. When you die, the bird-killing hind toe carries you to the Arch of Orion. When you die, you go back to the clay and fog. When you die, the golems will cry. When you die, the world disappears. When you die, I will die. Mimi's son, born bad, is pulled out like water from a well. Large forceps embrace his neck. The tumble of sounds he pushes back. His arms, oars. Jugular vein thumps. There are squirrels on the roof. Mimi's words shake up rough. They fall out of her mouth like unripe berries. Several nurses have to hold her down. Mimi roars, woman of a thousand heads on all fours, the forceps still stuck somewhere, the egg sandwich vomited onto white sheets. The baby is suddenly surrounded by numb flesh, his head in the slow current of a dark pond.
Can you talk a little bit about where that piece came from?
So this character, Mimi, is based on a great grandmother of mine. And again, when I say based on, it's not that Mimi is the great grandmother, but it is inspired by her. And in some ways, she holds the larger, maybe collective story of many of my ancestors who came over from the Ukraine after the pogroms around the turn of the 20th century. So that story came a lot out of some of the research I did in the Ukraine, and also thinking about how what do you do when you've never really met an ancestor or a relative, but these stories about them very much live with you. And so this was her story, was a story that lived with me in a very active way. And so part of what I was interested in is sort of thinking about cross-pollinating the story that was handed over to me with some of the research I was doing, both in the Ukraine and also in the U.S. at Ellis Island and other places, just sort of points of entry where people had come in. And then also going to Milwaukee and thinking about some of the more immediate family geographies there. Hmm. So the story is really a mix of my research, this kind of passed down memory of the ancestor, and then sort of as the third piece would be just again the dream state, right? This, the information that comes to you when you're contemplating something, when you're activated around something, when you take charge of a particular subject, and what else synchronistically happens then while you're occupied with that. And so a lot of, for me, that's in some ways I think of these, having written these stories, was also sort of ritualistic or a kind of rite where I would be for weeks or even months thinking about this particular person, doing work and research, and then other things would happen that would inform the story, and that's kind of how it would come together.
Mm. Well, one of the things I would love to, as we sort of approach the end of our conversation, is to talk about writing art in this particular period of time. In one interview, you were asked what the theoretical concerns are behind your writing and what kinds of questions you're trying to answer, what even you think the current questions are. And you answered with a list of questions. You said, how can I approach you with care? What is hiding behind our disastrous present? What are the invisible worlds communicating? What is the root of this country's sorrow? How will we live here now? And somehow I connected these questions to a couple of sentences in a piece that you wrote for the Elephants magazine called Orientation, where you say, this backward stare, this return song is not a nostalgia for origin, not a mourning for a burning city, for all of our cities are burning. It is, it must be, a tracing of what on that first spur, roving forward, storming ahead, was overlooked, and which, through surreptitious circumstances, may still lie wayside, waiting to be seen. It made me wonder if this was in some ways sort of an ars poetica for you, an aesthetic or ethical approach to how to create art when all of our cities are on fire. But whether it is or not, I would love to hear, and I'm sure a lot of artists today would love to hear your thoughts about you know, writing, creating art and creating objects and in our current situation.
I would, so starting with that quote, that's particularly relevant for me right now because I am working on a project that, again, returns me to Germany and to the country, you could say, of my origin. And I was really, I have been really interested in the way, and I guess this is, as I'm saying this out loud, I'm realizing how just, in some ways it's the same thing that Uncountry is doing. It's just a little bit kind of packaging it a little bit differently. But it's thinking about how history never actually ends, right? So this kind of idea of a closed past is sort of a myth or is an illusion. And I'm really interested in the ways in which sort of historical events, so in particular right now I'm looking at the time in Germany sort of pre-World War I, which was, we just had that centennial, you know, roundabout. And so thinking about how 100 years later, going back to Berlin, what is similar, what is still happening, what is sort of reoccurring, and what might be different, or from where have we moved on? And to me, the feeling is very much of a circularity. And so I'm interested in treating history not as something that is closed off or that is ever finished, but that kind of keeps moving forward and is part of now as much as new things are happening, right? So it's kind of this thinking of the way time maybe functions not as linear, but as circular. I think the task right now of how to write when all our cities are burning does come back to, and maybe maybe that's not enough for some people, but for me right now it has a lot to do with what do I pay attention to and what do I choose to take charge of, so and thereby what am I charging. So the question of again, there's vast materials to work with, and to be very specific around what do I take up and choose to illuminate. And I'm thinking also of, you know, a writer like Sebald, who was important for me with Uncountry, and the way he would really kind of take up the most forgotten, remote, unimportant places and objects and sort of imbue them with a kind of consciousness or with thought or with attention simply. And I find that a very powerful gesture. And to go into into the small places or into forgotten places that may not be getting that much visibility, and to charge those, I think, is feels central to my work, at least.
Yeah, and there's that almost sounds or feels like it has an archaeological impulse to it. And it reminds me, I don't know if that seems strange to you or not, but it reminds me, going back to the beginning of our conversation, the quote by Hélène Cissou, which we never quoted, but one part of it, she says, I like beings who belong to removal inhabitants of the uncountry, of the in-country, of the country hidden in the country, or lost in the country, of the other country, the country below, the country underneath. And the way that, in this sense, if we think of the country below and the country underneath, it's not just that time is circular, but that it's spatial, that we're walking on history that's here at the same time. Like you can dig, and the history mm-hmm. is there also. And the digging, finding, metaphorically speaking, the unseen things that need to be charged that aren't being charged, sounds like that's somehow connected to that as well.
Yes, I think that's very true, and I do often feel like I'm digging. Actually, that's interesting that you bring that up. That somehow writing for me relates very much to a going underneath, and even reading. Sometimes I think of the underworld journey, you know, as a kind of process for writing. It's a sort of like having to vacate something of the here and now in this kind of. The present world and the visible world, and having to sort of descend to go into a process of descending in order to get to what the nuggets that lie buried in the dark. And I also think there is I was just trying to remember, if I don't think it was Winnicott Cern herself who said this, but it might have been her someone who wrote about her, who talked about her interest or her part of her compulsion for writing having to do with the mythical poverty of her times. And there's something for me that, again, that was said like maybe the 1960s, but that feels, or the 1950s, but that feels relevant today as well too. So the mythical poverty and sort of how to re-engage with or find a kind of mythic quality in our daily lives that seems important as a form of instruction, how to move forward or how to live here now.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we can end with the section called Falling.
Mm-hmm. Falling. I'm falling out of a window, pushed by a man in a red flannel jacket. I sat on the sill next to a small cacti arrangement. I'm halfway down. I cannot help but think that fathers are powerful magicians. I laugh and spit rushes into the air. Yes, upwards. Below, a caravan of children snakes across the street. The one day I fall out of a window. The street looks like a fat artery, a border, or a landscape of obstacles. I know we rarely get to do this. Join the leaving, the animals, and sail. I remember that I never looked up the meaning of the word interstice. My finger will not trace the dictionary anymore, only infinity. I pass a balcony with steaming teapots, mothers over brunch. I see two birds in the crown of a tree, devouring each other. I would like to kiss the face of a stranger while the wind undresses me, to be called the comet of awe. I would like to slip out of the generous handshake and scream words, beavers, Florentine, shuttle ass. We sleep with our tongues out. Will there be a crack on the street? Will I bounce off the black car metal? Will the dog bark? I flip my body, my face sunlit. I do not believe in blood or the second coming. I forlive death. I will return as a horse, sleet, bad breath. Give me a piece of behind. Of what you said, of what you said, of what you said, I think. I'm almost done falling. I'm not a leaf. aluminum, fajitas, tennis courts. These might be my last four words. The crowd below is collectively raising their arms to imitate a gravity shield. They pray in combinations. The balcony mothers wave. Utterly, utterly. Do you want to know how? Do you think I should do it face down or back broken into asphalt? I once was in a city in a tram accident. All the wine bottles broke and red the floor. Someone cried, "This is not happening." The noise approaches, the very familiar sounds. I must be close. This is the beginning of a new sequence. Death of the horizontal, birth of the vertical. We can never be clever enough. But I know that any minute, my God will come forward, step out of the hazel, and change my course.
Thanks for being on Between the Covers today, Yanara.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
We're talking today to writer Yanara Friedland about her latest book from Naomi Press, On Country and Mythology. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
And you're tuned to Community Radio, KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. And we are at 91.9 FM, Columbia Gorge, and 104.3 FM, Philomath and the Willamette Valley.